Chapter 2. The Tutor.
As I have said, I never saw that girl again. Nor did I see any other one like her. Nothing ever reminded me of her when my father took me with him on his visits to the bay. But of course I did not need to be reminded. And I did not need to be at the bay's palace to think of her. I thought of her all the time. To the bay, obviously, she had just been an idea, a fancy, something to be tried out once, to be savored for a moment, to be dismissed, to be followed by the next idea, the next fancy, and yes, in his gardens, at his palace, over the years, I did see some of those, who meant not more nor less to him than she had done. To me, they meant nothing. They were part of the scenery. They lived, they suffered, they died, under eagerly watchful eyes, or alone and forgotten. But she had become my obsession. I learned to stay still, to take off my clothes, to recline on a not too uncomfortable piece of furniture in a not too uncomfortable but revealing pose, to keep my eyes open and to stay still. There was no one to reveal myself to. There was no one into whose eyes to lock my gaze. I looked into emptiness, into a corner of my large room with its sparse furniture, high ceiling, large windows, bare walls onto which the sun drew its patterns, shadows of the huge old trees outside. But I defied the temptation to look at the patterns as they moved, as the wind blew through the leaves and branches, as the sun moved slowly across the sky. I looked into nothingness, as I stayed still, as I looked into her eyes, into her dark eyes, and into her crystal ones. Sometimes, though, it scared me. I settled down opposite the big mirror and, for hours, looked into my own eyes. I never sewed my lips or my labia, but occasionally, to prove to myself that I could, I pierced them with sewing needles. I had my two arms, but I learned to get through whole days pretending they were gone, not using them, keeping them tucked away behind my back, though sometimes I cheated. I had my eyes, real ones, not crystal ones, but sometimes I kept them closed for a whole day, and I cheated only rarely. I did not shave my head, but for my sessions of staying still, I hid my long, dark blonde, not quite golden hair underneath a plain white scarf. And when the hair on my body began to grow, between my legs and underneath my arms, I regularly removed it, with the wax from molten candles. The most important thing to me, though, the essence of my being her, was to be absolutely still for hours. When I had gotten through a particularly demanding self-imposed task without cheating, I rewarded myself by touching myself between my thighs. Sometimes, though not always, I did it in front of the mirror. I had time for these games. I was alone most of the time. My mother had died not long after my birth. I have no memory of her. Her tomb is in a hidden corner of our garden. There is a whispered rumor that her voice had been heard from the tomb for many days after my father had buried her there. The tomb is built of granite, only half immersed into the earth, with small ventilation holes in its padlocked, heavy and now rusted iron door. So she might have been heard had she still lived. But I have never met anyone who whispered that they had heard her themselves, only that they had heard the tale. I have always shunned that part of the garden, but then I mostly stayed inside the house anyway, where it was cool and safe and quiet, and where I had my privacy. My father was gone most of the time on his voyages, trading, or on one of his missions for the bay. We only had a small staff of four, three women and a man, none of them of any interest to me, for the large garden and the house, which was big and old and not in the best repair, and gave them enough work to do, so they were happy enough to disobey my father's orders and obey mine instead, which were to keep me alone as much as possible, and never, ever intrude on me without warning, and outside our prearranged times and locations. It helped that I knew, and they knew that I knew, that they were lazy, and kept long breaks when my father was away, and, as I soon found out, regularly cheated with grocery and maintenance bills. It really was an arrangement to both their and my own benefit. Food they were to leave in an anteroom of my quarters. The staff lived in an outbuilding, and the house was large enough, with my father and me as the sole occupants, for me to have my own suite of rooms. From time to time, I let them in to clean my rooms. They always praised me for how tidy I kept them, and how I always carefully put away all my toys. I had many toys. My father was quite generous in this regard. From every journey, he brought me pretty dolls in garments of precious fabrics, and doll houses, and carved animals, and wooden ships, and carts with real wheels, and castles complete with warriors, handmaids, artisans, court jesters, princesses, princes, towers, turrets, balconies, drawbridges, dungeons, and moats. It was little effort for me to keep all my toys neatly stowed away, for I never played with them and never took them out. When my father decided it was time for me to have a tutor, I was worried. But I soon found out that I had nothing to fear from him. He was a young priest, looking even younger than what his years must have been. Lean, tall, dark-haired, mild-voiced, mild-mannered, mild-faced, and dressed in a black cassock. A castrate, as fit his profession, but, while having a melodious contralto voice, he showed nothing of the physical features, softness, flabbiness, obesity, that are generally believed to go with the loss of the male sexual organs, and he had lost them completely, by his own hands, and proud of it, penis and testicles, as I later had ample opportunity to see. I was happy to find out, almost on the first day, that he was as uncomfortable with the idea of our spending 8 hours a day together, 6 days a week, for the benefit of my education, as I was. The agreement that we soon reached was that we had one meeting Monday morning, where he told me the syllabus for the week, and a second meeting Saturday evening, where he satisfied himself, mostly by trusting my assertions, that I had mastered it. What he did in the time between, I neither knew nor cared about. But what I did, unencumbered by annoying, watchful, or helpful eyes, but with full access to my father's huge library, was to read and to learn. When I was through with my week's curriculum, usually by Monday afternoon, I grabbed whatever books attracted my fancy and eagerly absorbed whatever they had to offer me. I spent less time now sitting absolutely still and staring at empty corners or into my own eyes in the mirror, though I still did it, but many more hours I now spent sitting still and staring into books. Still naked, of course. I could not sit absolutely still, for my eyes had to move as I read, and I could not pretend not to have arms and hands, as I needed them to hold the books and turn the pages. But I pretended they were not part of my body. They were purely some ingenious mechanical devices for book reading. And I could not use them for anything else, like for scratching myself when some spot on my skin itched, or for holding a glass of water to my mouth when I got thirsty. Violations of sitting still that were not allowed anyway, but being without arms made it easier to resist the temptation. And as before, to that other temptation, when I had been good at keeping my own rules, I often gave in, with almost as little motion and with the same solemnity and patience. The change that came was sudden and unexpected. All those hours of sitting still, learning, reading, or silently abandoning myself to self-absorbed passion demanded a compensation, and about twice a day, I raced up and down the stairs at full speed, along corridors, through flights of rooms, ending up in my bedroom where I threw myself upon my bed, against my bed, beating and kicking with all my force whatever soft targets it offered of mattresses, pillows, and blankets, until I fell down, exhausted, covered in sweat, utterly out of breath, but strangely exalted. If the housekeepers, whom I did my best to avoid, ever knew about it, they never mentioned it. And of course, I never did it during the rare weeks when my father was at home. As a matter of course, I kept these exercises from my tutor. Like my exercises in immobility, like masturbating, like my own thoughts and dreams, this was part of my private life, not meant for the eyes of an intruder, and he would not have been less an intruder than anybody else. Until, one day, I made a mistake. Or maybe he did. Strangely, I never tried to work out exactly how it happened. One day, he was in my sitting room, the room in which we usually met, and through the open door to my bedroom, he saw my breathless, violent, desperate cushion attack. I became aware of him only after I had exhausted myself and realized that he had stood there, watching me, for quite a while. I looked at him in horror. Too weak to scream, too weak to run, too weak to grab some clothes and hide my nakedness. All I wanted to do was die. I knew I had nothing to fear from him. I hadn't done anything evil or forbidden, but I had been invaded, and nothing could ever undo that, could it? I looked at him in horror, and I expected his face to show silent contempt, suppressed or open ridicule, blank incomprehension, concern, guilt, embarrassment, denial, before turning away and leaving me to my misery. As the seconds passed, I pleaded with him silently to leave. But he did not turn, nor did his face betray any emotions. The silence, the tension, became unbearable.
"You do not know how to fight," he finally said.
Of course I didn't, even though I had leafed through some books of martial arts.
"Do you want to learn?"
I do not remember when I had last cried before, or if I ever had, but now I cried, and I did not feel ashamed. I did not really understand why I cried either. "Yes," I said, "I want to."
"We begin then,"
he said, taking off his cassock, underneath which he was naked. I wanted to protest. I was exhausted. I was emotionally shaken. I was not prepared. Surely we could wait until tomorrow. But I knew that at this moment I had learned my first lesson, and I looked at him, and he bowed to me, and with as earnest a face as his, I returned his bow. From that day on, my life changed. We exercised twice a day, 3 hours each, 6 days a week, except for the irregular intervals of time when my tutor was taking his leave. And, of course, except when my father was present, who, fortunately, showed little interest in the details and progress of my education. His interest in me, incidental enough as it was of a very different kind, after all. We exercised with dummies, which we built from blankets, pillows, and cords, but mostly we exercised with each other. I learned the five paths: the path of the mind, the path of the body, the path of environment, the path of the opponent, the path of combat. By teaching you the five paths, by teaching them to anyone outside the Brotherhood, I break a solemn oath, he once told me. We had never spoken more than the absolutely necessary before, and we still did not speak much, but unavoidably we were closer to each other now. Before, I had not even cared about what to call him. Now I asked for his name. I was still very young. I was not aware that his name might not be the correct form of address. "Call me Almagest," he said. I looked it up at my father's library. It meant something like, "The Master, the Source of Knowledge." It was good enough for me. My tutor had a name now. I never showed him, but secretly I was proud of it. He hardly spoke about himself, and I never asked. But I learned that he was an exile, of his country, of his family, of the Brotherhood, wherever and whatever they were. Even less I learned about his present life, like where he went and what he did when he took his leaves, or even where he lived, which my father must have known, I suppose, but I never asked him either. We did not have time for idle talk, of course. My training, incessantly exploring the limits of my physical and mental powers, transgressing them, expanding them, testing them anew, took all our time and breath. He never spared me. My body was constantly covered in cuts and bruises, and more than once I suffered broken bones, which he taught me how to treat, as he taught me many other healing skills. I took up weird ostentatious sports, like climbing trees in our garden, falling down with conspicuous clumsiness, to account for my injuries when I feared they might become too noticeable, even to casual and uninterested observers. During all the time, I never flinched, I never hesitated. I took my lessons with the same determination with which I had exercised immobility, and I still saw before me the still and silent armless girl with her dark and crystal eyes. I learned. The years passed, and I learned. And I grew up. By the time when my father took me with him for the final visit to the bay, my breasts had already grown to the size where I wished they would stop growing. I had never found large breasts to be beautiful or desirable. The bay, I suppose, felt differently, for he looked at me with a discernible lack of enthusiasm, as I stood before him naked. This had been the purpose of the visit, to let him look at me. Except for my two small breasts, I think I didn't look that bad, though. Even my skin was mostly unblemished and unbruised, as Almagest had left several weeks ago and not yet returned. I kept up my exercises in his absence, but, bereft of a training partner, mostly regarding the first two paths, mental and physical self-control, and they didn't bruise me that much. My knowledge of the third and fourth path helped me, without doing anything, and there wasn't much I could have done to pass the bay's scrutiny.
"She will do," he said.
Maybe it should have been better for me if I wouldn't have done, if I hadn't passed. Should I have tried to fail? Could I have failed if I had tried to? I do not know, but as I stood there, I was very sure that whatever bad not failing might bring me, failing would easily have brought me worse. So whatever my own part in it finally had or hadn't been, she will do it was. I would do as the Khan's wife, as one of the Khan's wives, of course, but as his main wife, his public wife, for 1 year. The Khan took a new wife each year, from one of the provinces, to strengthen their ties with their ruler, to proudly display, for everybody to be seen, the unity of his empire, embodied in his august person. Why I had been chosen, I did not know, but there probably had not been that many girls to choose from, once the Khan's decision had fallen upon our province for this year. The Khan's bride must come from a good and well-connected family, but not so good and well-connected that others might view their promotion to being the Khan's new in-laws as a threat to themselves. My father, I think, fit this perfectly. She must be young, but not too young. She must be reasonably pretty. She must be unattached. A teary-eyed bride lamenting the separation from her lover would be a nuisance. And she must be educated and confident enough to be presentable, to be able to perform her representational duties. And it was the Bey who had to choose her and approve of her, and who would suffer the consequences if he chose badly. So, given that he knew me, and given his close ties with my father, of what nature they were I never knew, I seemed to have been the logical choice. There were no further questions, no further tests. My father must have vouched for me. We left the next day. I did not regret leaving my home. I had never really considered it my home anyway. I regretted that I could not say goodbye to my tutor. "Will you do it for me?" I asked my father. "If I see him," he replied. There was one more question I had. "What will be after that year?" I asked as we set sail. "Do not worry. They will find some use for you," my father reassured me.